Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
So, Tommy, I want to just read you a tweet.
I'm so excited.
Even though I know you've already read it because you're on Twitter all the time.
All the time.
Literally every 2 minutes. So this is from at MechBlank.
MechBlank.
One of the OGs.
OG MechBlank. MechBlank.
Way. We love you lots. She said, I will literally pay you guys $10 if you let me talk about Bye Bye Birdie with you for 5 minutes on the podcast. I consider myself Twitter's only Bye Bye Birdie stan. For my qualifications, please see my bio as well as this photo of the Bye Bye Birdie sticker on my laptop.
Ah, Jimmy, we missed out on $10.
Wait, I know, exactly. But what would that be? Would that be $10 each? Would that be $5?
What's the conversion rate to... What do you guys use? Scots? What are they called? You just use Lucky Charms, right?
Yeah. Hypni bits.
I don't know what happened.
That isn't even a thing. It's an amalgamation of a thing.
Hypni bits?
Hypni bits. So a hypni, you know, like a threepenny?
Oh, okay. A threepenny, like the opera.
A hypni's a half one.
A hypni... Hypni bits?
Hey, like, say the word hey.
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 Hey,
as in like, you know, hello.
Right, but say then that. I would say hey.
That's fine, and then say pni.
Hey pni.
Stunning.
Diddly diddly dee.
Yes, we don't. We're not Irish.
Diddly diddly dee.
Not that that is Irish, but the way it's just to say. So yeah, cheers.
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour. I'm Tommy.
And I'm Jimmy. And this is the only musical theater podcast with crap booze.
And tap shoes.
That's where we're at with rhymes now, guys. That's where we're at.
Here, we take apart your favorite shows, muddle them together with a shot of buffoonery, and pour you a refreshing glass of musical theater conversation. Jimmy, what are you drinking today?
Milk! That was good. That was a good read, wasn't it?
It was good. I told you that was going to work.
Yeah, that works. Why? Well, I've got a quiz question.
I'm so excited.
Ready?
I'm so ready.
Okay. So, according to legend, such as King Arthur.
Yeah. Dramatic music plays.
Yeah, exactly. At the rap party for the movie adaptation of this musical, it was either Maureen Stapleton or Paul Lind who stood up and said to one of the leading female actresses, I want you to know that I'm the only person who worked in this film who doesn't want to fuck you.
What could it be?
It could only be Bye Bye Birdie. What I would quite like is if we only refer to it as Bye Bye Birdie.
Bye Bye Birdie. Like Cora Hoover Hooper. Bye Bye Birdie.
Hoover Hoover. Yeah, Bye Bye Birdie. Because that's now what I call it in my head.
It is my good friend who in some musical mash watch with me's is the Pink Text. This might have even made it into the time when we watched the 1995 Bye Bye Birdie, pointed out to me the fact that Anne Margaret sings Bye Bye Birdie. Like, it is just entirely the wrong consonant.
What I don't understand is how you didn't notice it before.
I totally over my head. I've seen the movie plenty of times.
There's there's just no D there whatsoever. There's no D, D, there's no, it's just he.
You know, maybe it's because in places where there's no D whatsoever, I usually don't notice that.
Hey.
Oh, it's not. Good. It's not even midnight where I'm at.
I know.
Bye, bye, Birdie. Jimmy had never listened to this before.
I dipped in, but I'd never taken it in as a full experience, Tommy. So there you go.
Which is
there's that. But it's so, a similar chat to Music Man.
Sure, yeah.
We don't deal in Bye Bye Birdie over here.
Which is so fascinating. So Bye Bye Birdie premiered in 1960 on Broadway. It's got music by Charles Strauss, lyrics by Lee Adams, and a book by Michael Stewart.
Yes, indeed. All newbies. And it did extremely well. It played for 607 performances, which again at that time is still pretty damn good.
Absolutely.
It won the Tony for Best Musical. Mm-hmm. Well done, well done. Dick Van Dyke also won the Tony for his leading role. It won Best Direction, Best Choreography, and has kind of just enjoyed notorious success in America since.
Still super popular. Adapted into a movie in 1963 with much of the original Broadway cast, and has had several revivals since, and is a super popular high school show.
Yeah. Surely, like... Is it Grease and Bye Bye Birdie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think
Do you know these stats?
Both have fallen out of favor in recent years.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, Even Grease.
I think Grease, like, we've kind of gone past... I'll show you the moon. I think our, like, kind of contemporary woke culture is pushing down lots of pieces of Grease and Bye Bye Birdie. Mm, I think appropriately okay. So.
Fair.
Getting younger theater teachers and more, you know, socially aware theater teachers and theater departments starts to do this thing. But also, they're kind of outliving their datedness, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But yeah, like, I've done Bye Bye Birdie in schools. I have not done Grease.
Interesting.
Grease is one where I appreciate most of all of the directors that I work with, and when they choose shows, as a tech person, I'm always given some, you know, veto power, and also I'm never given the onus of picking the show, which is a perfect place to be in. But I do.
Yeah.
Bye Bye Birdie and Grease are both right on the opposite ends of, or the, like, they're very close to my line of what I do and don't want to do. Bye Bye Birdie, I am absolutely okay doing. Grease, I'm not okay doing, but they're both right there, which is...
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know what that says about my values as a tech theater director.
Yeah, exactly. I feel it's interesting, and we'll get into their relationship, I guess,
sure.
a bit. But they feel a bit like star-crossed lovers.
They do. They are... Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
So... Bye Bye Birdie. I think it'd be entertaining if I attempt this.
Please.
For how tired I am.
Yeah,
so
and having being new to it, tell me what it's about.
Yeah, okay. So, Albert Peterson is a songwriter, and one of his biggest clients who's been kind of propelled into fame is Mr. Conrad Birdie. Mm-hmm. And Conrad Birdie has just been drafted into the army.
Uh-oh.
And is set to leave in 2 weeks?
2 weeks in a short amount of time.
In a short amount of time. And so, as a big kind of last hurrah and sort of PR stunt, they want to let him perform a song on the Ed Sullivan Show. And on that performance, he is gonna kiss one of his fans as he serenades them, and that fan is Miss Kim McAfee of Sweet Apple, Ohio.
What a generic Midwestern town name!
Exactly, and. Kim is obviously very excited. Her family maybe less so, but they are excited to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show. Stuff ensues. There's back and forths. Albert's relationship with his secretary, Rose, it comes into play, and he has a awful mother. And there's hijinks and a happy ending.
There you go. I'm so proud of you.
Thanks very much. Oh, dear.
I think this show has a deceptively complex plot.
I think it has an unnecessarily complex plot. But it's the 60s. Well, it's just the 60s.
It's just the 60s.
So I don't mind.
No, and it is very much a thing of its era. Shall we shall we talk about its era?
Its era sounds good to me. Hooked, then you're really cooked. What you gonna do? What you gonna do? I was trying to think of a good, like, era pun there. Like, you betcha, but, like, you bera, or you bera talk about that. Like, bera. I don't know. You're going to have a great time today.
Oh, I'm so excited.
We all are.
We all are. We always do.
We all are. Professional. Come on. Right. So, this was written... In the 60s. In the late 50s.
In the late 50s, early 60s, and is set in the 60s. This is one of those... I use this word more and more to describe this thing, but I think I'm one of the few people who does. This is a contemporaneous musical. It was written about now, just now happens to be 1960s.
It is indeed. And at the time, it was a very accurate reflection of... the world? Would you say that?
Absolutely. I mean, largely inspired by actual happenings to the one and only Elvis Presley.
Exactly. So, I think it was Michael Stewart who had the idea first.
That sounds right. Yeah.
It might have been Charles Strauss. I don't know. It also might have been the producer. I can't remember. Anyway, no, I think it was Charles Strauss. It doesn't matter. One of the creative team had the kind of idea... after seeing the sort of furore that was created when Elvis was drafted into the army, he had the idea of writing a musical about that.
Yes.
And I'm kind of obsessed with that as just an idea.
Yeah?
Of just like, here is like a kind of news story. Let's write a musical about that.
Sure.
But not about that.
Right, but like inspired
based
by that.
Upon that.
Yeah.
Like, I was trying to think of another situation where that has happened, where it's like a specific, like, inciting incident.
Yeah.
Right? That's notable.
Yeah.
But not like, you know, a war or not like...
Right.
I don't know.
You're sleepy. Come from away.
But see, I don't know because that, well, no, Come From Away might be a good idea.
Yeah.
Because it's about Gander specifically.
Yeah. Chicago, the play that the musical is based on, is inspired by an actual, I think they might have changed the names, but it was a like 1920s gangster, you know, or flapper arrest in Chicago. Like it was a thing.
Okay.
It was inspired by news stories.
Okay, not, that's fair.
Not to take all the air out of your sails.
No, but I still think like it was just a man getting drafted into the army.
Sure, I do.
Do you know what I mean? And
I do find it interesting.
I find it really interesting.
Well, and that it is so specifically based on a real event, but still fictionalized, which does
through and through, like
right, which does set it apart from, say, Come From Away, which is much less fictionalized.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So yeah, I'm sticking with my point, Thomas. I'm sticking with it, and I'm going to run with it. So yeah, I can't wait for the 4,000 things of like, well, you forgot about that. I'm like, yes, I did forget about it. I have a brain. So anyway, I just think that is a really, really interesting inception. And I think it really feeds into the fact that this is a very, as you say, contemporaneous musical. It is almost a nice little snapshot.
Yeah. Well, and
of the time.
That is one of the fascinating things to me about this show, is that it is parts of it have absolutely withstood the test of time, and parts of it are so absolutely dated, and they stand mm-hmm. so distinctly hand in hand, which is when you do it, especially as I did it with middle schoolers, that gets kind of tough. Like, you know, you don't see, we're starting to see this with other shows that started as a, this is real life, this is nowadays on stage, and now mm-hmm. we do as kind of a reference to a bygone era.
Yeah.
But like when Bye Bye Birdie came out, it wasn't like, oh, remember the 60s? But now it feels like remember the 60s.
Yeah, very much so. But what's quite interesting about it is obviously woven into the book are all these very 60s references.
Oh, yes.
You know, that really, me as a Scottish mm-hmm. Millennial,
yeah.
go way over my head.
Yeah. So like, let's take a big one. You, I assume, because you're an Amerophile, but you know who Ed Sullivan is.
I knew who Ed Sullivan was. I knew the Ed Sullivan Show was a thing.
Sure.
But beyond that,
yeah.
Je n'ai pas.
Yeah. Well, and that's, so then when you're trying to teach a bunch of, you know, seventh graders about it in, 2016 or whenever we did it.
Right.
And like, we could say to them, just think of like Ellen DeGeneres. And we did have this moment where we were like, gosh, are there any other, could you be like James Corden? Like, could you, you know, like,
yeah,
Conan O'Brien? Like, there's no,
yeah.
And like, not only does no one's name fit in there, none of those late night or even daytime, even Ellen or like maybe Oprah, but Oprah is so different. In like what Ed Sullivan did, like Ed Sullivan invented the late night talk show, as we know it, at least.
Yeah. And I think like his was more, it just felt more variety based mm-hmm. as opposed to now it's really about the host.
Yeah.
Whereas, and certainly, you know, from what my research has shown, Ed Sullivan's show wasn't about him.
No.
And obviously that's, you know, the facts about the host is a product of a lot of things.
Sure, absolutely.
You need an icon. But he was just like the kind of lovely part of it
yeah.
that everyone fell in love with.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, you didn't watch the Ed Sullivan Show
yeah.
to see Ed Sullivan.
Right. You watched, but to, you know, Harry McAfee's delight, being on the Ed Sullivan Show would very much feel today like being on Ellen or something.
Exactly. Exactly.
And like,
hi, Ellen.
Right. Different song.
Did you know that's actually based on Ellen DeGeneres?
Well, stop.
No.
That was another thing. And this is a thing I'm running into more and more teaching uh-huh. adolescents about plays that weren't written in the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Phones have changed rapidly, dynamically, and with like the whole concept of telephone hour doesn't make sense anymore.
Not at all.
And which is so, which I find specifically strange, knowing that Be More Chill does a like
a send up,
like a almost one for one send up of telephone hour called the smartphone hour. And when yeah. you analyze it from that perspective, it's one of the things where I think Be More Chill, the musical, kind of misses the point of the contemporary American. And like, we're the contemporary American child, like it's uh-huh. it's a parody, and if you get it, it's funny. But like, no, you know, they make a couple jokes about texting, but the vast majority of the plot manifests itself through phone conversations in that.
Yeah.
And be like, let me tell you, if high schoolers were telling other high schoolers that someone burnt someone else's house down, it would all be through text. But that's
all be through text. Or like Snapchat.
Right.
Like, if there wouldn't be a conversation.
Yeah,
happening.
No, it's, I made a TikTok about it.
Yeah, exactly.
But that doesn't make for compelling stage business.
It does not.
But like, explaining to kids how a corded phone works, and like, no, the cord has to go somewhere. Like, that's a thing. Yeah. That's a thing I've done in my life, which I just find so crazy to me because it is such a seminal moment in the show and a representation of a culture that is just gone.
Well, that's exactly it. It's that, you know, the reason why the telephone hour is in Bye Bye Birdie is because that was something that was going wild at that time.
Yeah.
Kids were coming straight home from school and they were speaking for hours on the phone,
right,
much to their parents' chagrin.
Right.
You know? And this was kind of the start of that happening, you know? And I think that's what's really nice about Bye Bye Birdie almost to look at, is that it does feel, as you say, like a period piece, like a little archive of 1960s America. And it feeds into everything, you know, like not just the actual the references, but the relationships, the family dynamics, and of course rock and roll.
Well, and that's the thing, is that, like, sure, the telephone hour explicitly would be a really weird thing to happen nowadays in contemporary America. But the spirit that it embodies of teenagers having this, like, you know, like, hiya Hugo, what you wanna go get pinned for? Like, you know, you could find the contemporary, like, and people don't even do this anymore, but like, why'd you change your Facebook relationship status? Like, the themes are absolutely still extant. We just do them differently now. And like, that's the crazy thing about it, is like, sure, rock and roll was the, you know, the boogeyman then, in a very particular way. And we have so many different ones now, that instead of rock and roll, it's just, you know, I don't know. Vaping? That's not right.
they actually are like for like equivalents. But no, it's, well, I think if we're looking from a musical perspective, one of the things that I said was really notable about Be More Chill.
Yeah.
Is the fact that it's using more like rock, kind of emo-y music. And emo is the, well, it kind of was the subculture.
Was the rock and roll of emo's time, right? Like,
these
things, we put different covers on the same book sometimes. And they have different flavors and things change, certainly.
Yeah.
But I think it's like the core of Bye Bye Birdie, and the reason why people like it, is because it kind of found these themes. That seem to be very, I don't know if they're very American, but those themes have stood the test of time.
Yeah, I think specifically musically, this is a really interesting one, because this was one of the first shows to put rock and roll on Broadway stage.
Absolutely.
And that's really interesting, because of how it treats rock and roll. So the rock and roll in this show, is very different to the rock and roll you'd find anywhere else on a Broadway show, maybe?
Yeah, I could. Tell me more. What do you mean?
So what I'm getting at, basically, your main kind of rock and roll focus, Conrad Birdie, is it just one of the silliest and most ridiculous characters in musical theater history.
Sure, yeah.
Like, he is an airhead. He has no depth. He is just kind of a mouthpiece.
Yeah.
For something or other.
Yeah.
And what that shows is the creative team's feelings about rock and roll.
Right.
What I think they've done is they've identified that, here, this is a thing.
Yeah.
Let's kind of look at this, because obviously contemporaneous to 1960s, this was the advent of rock and roll, and so they've decided to write it, but they're writing it from the perspective of the adults,
right,
not understanding how important and how significant it is to the kids.
I see what you're saying. I think they do strike a little deeper. Because I think Conrad's song, A Lot of Livin' to Do, and especially Act Two Conrad, kind of blows that up a little bit. Like, Conrad is an idiot in Act One, and I think a little less of an idiot in Act Two.
Do you think? Or do you think he's still just a big idiot? What does he do?
There is a sense, there's something, and I don't know, maybe I'm off base, but I get the sense in Act Two that Conrad has a moment of being slightly more sympathetic. He has this moment where he gets pretty angry at Albert and like storms out like everyone's doing to Albert in that moment. In this kind of like, I'm sick of you controlling my life, man. I got a lot of living to do. And that is the inciting incident for a lot of living to do. Now, the things he goes to do is like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Like, it's not a very laudable moment, but you do get this brief moment of like, oh, this kid, you know, also is just trying to deal with his unexpected fame.
But what I want you to try and do, right, is put your brain inside the head of a 1960s parent.
Sure.
Are you going to watch him casting off at your hero?
Yeah.
Right? Mouthing off at your hero.
Yeah.
To go and kick up some fuss at the local dive bar.
Sure.
Right? And be like, I approve. I love that.
I will. I guess the other thing I would add into my thesis bucket there is parents are not painted in a sympathetic light in this musical either. Albert's mother is terrible. Paul Lynde is a clown.
But see, this is it. It's really interesting because Paul Lynde is a clown. Mostly because Paul Lynde.
Because he's a clown. Don't get me wrong. Great character. Love it.
Absolutely. But I would say at no point does he feel like he is not in the wrong. That's not what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
Like, at no point is he being denigrated.
Okay.
I feel like,
He is a victim of his world.
Yeah. He's kind of.
He's painted as a victim of these kids, right? Like,
exactly. And it's like, kids to me doesn't feel like if you put your brain
sure.
in this adult scene, it doesn't feel like a parody song.
Yeah. Kids is one of the few songs in the show that I think has entirely withstood the test of time.
It has, but it's the meaning of it has completely changed.
Yeah, but I think the joke is, why can't they be like, we were perfect in every way? But that's the joke. You weren't. Kids are kids, right? Like, when, you know, Kim and Hugo grow up to have their kids in the non-canonical sequel that doesn't exist. Like, they could sing the same song about their kids. And, you know, always on Facebook, what's a Fortnite? Like, over and over again. And, like, that is the joke. But I don't know. Am I reading in a 2019 meaning into a song from 1960?
That's the thing, is I wonder if we are just too, like, because of course that's what it reads like nowadays.
Yeah.
Of course that, and it's saying, but is there ever a moment where parents are sitting in like, huh, you're so right, kids are f-ing annoying.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
The joke then is that Harry McAfee's other child,
yeah,
Little Randall sings the reprise of Kids, and like that's a joke, like that complicates things.
It does, and I think it makes it more like justified in what Paul Lynde was saying. Like, I think it backs him up, I don't know. I don't think Bye Bye Birdie is the celebration of rock and roll that Grease became.
Sure, that's fair.
Right? Because it's rock and roll was adopted by the teens of the 60s and the 50s.
Yeah.
as their subculture. This was the beginning of youth subculture.
Sure. And there is, I mean, Bye Bye Birdie and Grease have more than a decade difference between them. And Grease was not contemporaneous.
No.
Just barely.
Exactly.
But I think that it is a very hindsight is 2020. I will say, and this is a thing I'm looking at as I look at the, you know, kind of the timeline of musical theater. Bye Bye Birdie bringing rock and roll into musical theater might be, well, okay. This sentence I'm about to say has an asterisk next to it. But is one of the earliest, if not the earliest, incorporation of what you might consider an external music genre into the world of musical theater.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Like the year before it, you know, Sound of Music, like, and then even like The Music Man, okay, maybe like marching band, but that's doesn't feel the same.
No.
You know, and then I will also say there are some other like Tony Award nominees, like, oh, I don't know, Flower Drum Song, which maybe incorporates an external genre of music, but in a different kind of way, in a kind of like appropriating kind of way.
I'm about to poop on this because jazz.
Sure. But I would say prior to this,
in terms of like, but I think I know what you're meaning.
Because I would
because
say
you mean that rock and roll was new.
And rock and roll was not, like, there's plenty of jazz, like, musical theater and jazz were a little hand in hand for a long time.
That's the thing. Like, if we're talking about musical genres that came after the birth of the musical.
Right. The jazz, maybe, but still no one was like, and the first jazz music, right? Like,
No, but that's what I mean, sorry, is that rock and roll is the first piece of music that was adopted in. Yeah. Because, yeah, that's the thing. Jazz and musical theater came up together.
And it is, like, there's an interesting, I'm developing this thesis in my brain, but we do have, so often when I'm trying to, like, paint broad strokes about where, like, the musical theater timeline is, I'm looking at the Tony noms and the Tony winners for different years. 1958, The Music Man won. 1960, The Sound of Music won. 1961, Bye Bye Birdie won. And there's a bunch of other things in here, like Gypsy, a couple other, that might be the ones that I can point at least, where they are shows written with a diegetic music explanation inside of them. The Von Trapps sing, you know, Harold Hill brings a band to town. And then in Bye Bye Birdie, Conrad Birdie is a musician.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting thing that's happening around the turn of the decade between the 50s and the 60s, where we're like giving ourselves excuses to have music in a musical as opposed to we just burst into song. And then the wonderful added wrinkle of Bye Bye Birdie is that that music now is also like a story keystone. Like the, you know, Conrad Birdie sings rock and roll, and some of his non-diegetic songs are also rock and roll informed, which is, it's a cool cheat that I'm sure was an accident, but it lets you start putting a rock and roll sound into some of your non-rock and roll music. I think Got a Lot of Living to Do is the example, because you look at, like, Albert's songs and Rosie's songs and everyone else's songs, and they're musical theater through and through.
Yeah.
Conrad's songs are rock and roll, and Lot of Living to Do, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, has that rock and roll bass line to it.
Absolutely.
And so you get to start putting that into it, which is, you know, it's a and then the dams are released, you know, then this continues to happen until today.
Yeah, no, completely. I just think it is an interesting notch in the musical theater timeline because of that, because I don't think it existed, but I don't think it was representative of like, it's, that's what I mean. It doesn't feel like a celebration of rock and roll.
That's fair. Well, and this is, you know, 1961, we're still several decades out before, like, maybe Grease might actually be one of the first examples of a younger demographic.
A high school musical.
Yeah, a musical geared towards younger folk.
Precisely. And that's the thing is, like, you know, Grease had mass appeal with a younger generation.
Whereas Bye Bye Birdie is not, wasn't, I would wager, written to be a family musical even. Like,
no, I don't think so. That's what, and this is the thing, this is what I'm trying to get at, is that parents are coming to see this show. Adults are coming to see this show. And so they will be viewing it from their own experience. And that's why they'll be sitting right alongside Paul Lynde when he's singing about Ed Sullivan. Yeah. Because they're like, oh my God, yes, we absolutely love Ed Sullivan. Yeah. And when Anne Margaret is talking about being a... Sorry, not Anne Margaret Kim, but it's know, one and the same. Right. Is talking about how lovely it is to be a woman. That's funny for the women in the audience because they're like, oh, I remember when I was a teenager and all the changes were happening.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Teenagers aren't going to watch How Lovely to Be a Woman and be like, that's me right now.
Yeah, well...
Because it's not. It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, but it's also true. I don't know if I'm just more teenage adjacent. Like, absolutely, I could see one of the teenagers I work with be like, oh, that is me. When you, that, how lovely to be a woman when you switch from boys to men. Like, and fully and entirely believing it. There, when, you know, I work with teenagers, we deal with teenage drama, I deal with teenage drama on a daily basis. And one of the things one of our deans has said to me on several times when I'm dealing with, you know, whatever the recent breakup drama is of the week. And what she says all the time to the adults in the world is like, you know, puppy love may seem silly, but puppy love is real to puppies.
Yep.
And I do think there is a glimpse of that in this show. There is an honest teenager in here. I think no more exaggerated than Paul Lynde is an exaggerated father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. I don't think it's sympathetic towards them, though.
Sure.
I think, the upstanding teens are, like, Hugh.
Sure. But I think, what would
Kim has to learn to become an upstanding child.
But,
do you know what I mean? Like, by the end of it, Kim falls in line with...
We're missing the middle generation, and there are so many parallels between Kim and Rose and Albert and Hugo, and Albert and Rose are adults, and we watch their relationship struggles alongside Kim and Hugo's relationship struggles. Kim's like, Rose, I'm going to run away with you. Men are terrible. And they very intentionally draw a lot of those parallels.
Mm-hmm.
And Rose and Albert's love is complex and, you know, fraught with difficulty and certainly nothing to be poo-pooed. It's certainly viewed through a parodied heightened lens. Like, you're not, like, this is not some deep relationship drama that we're, you know, experiencing on stage. Like, this isn't Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or something. But... they're still drawing that, like, hey, adults have relationship difficulties, and so do teenagers. And they have different flavors, but we can look at both of them next to each other.
Yeah.
We haven't disagreed for several episodes.
We haven't. This is good, though. This is really good. Because, like, I don't know, I just feel... because by the end, Kim and Hugo are set to be the quintessential 1960s adult couple. It's like, you know, happy 2.4 children, subservient wife, and, you know, breadwinner husband.
Yeah.
I don't think the teens of the 60s wanted that, because this was the start of their counterculture. This was the start of their rebelling.
And you see that in Telephone Hour. Birthed. Like, did you really get what you wanna go get pinned for?
Like, and this is it, is like this idea of shunning that and casting that off is beginning. But instead, your two main, you know, your secondary love story has this happy ending of... welcome to traditional family life. Thank you very much.
Right. Yeah. You know,
it doesn't feel subversive. It doesn't feel, because if you look at Grease, if you look at the lens of Grease, it's the complete flip of that.
Yeah. Sure. I mean,
and I don't know. That's just
yeah.
That's how I see.
No, you're
the
totally
relationship
right. And like the fact that like even you know like Kim's "I Want" song is one boy, even though she kind of like protests against that about halfway through, but then ends up one boy. Like
exactly.
Sure. The teens in this are painted with an adult brush. That I absolutely agree with.
There are chicks just right for some kissing, and I mean to kiss me a few. Man, those chicks don't know what they're missing. I got a lot of living to do. Sizzling steaks all ready for tasting, and there's Cadillacs all shiny and new. Gotta move, 'cause time is a-wasting. I got a lot of living to do. There's music to play, places to go, people to see. Everything for you and me. Life's a ball, if only you know it. And it's all just waiting for you. You're alive, so come on and show it. Yeah, we got a lot of living to do.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
So one of the we've kind of touched upon it already, but I think one of the things that I noticed about this show, obviously listening to it fully for the first time, recently, is how kind of interesting it feels nowadays.
Yeah,
right.
And
I gutted myself laughing at the song "Kids."
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like, the reason I experienced Bye Bye Birdie first was because my mother had it on vinyl because she listened to it when she was Kim's age, right?
Right.
And now my mom's a boomer, at least in generation. And it's interesting because Harry McAfee feels like a boomer in some of the ways that we've kind of created that trope of what middle to late aged adults are in contemporary America or society.
So yeah, and this is, so I don't think we're as much in the habit of labeling things as we are now.
Sure.
So I don't know if like parents of that generation had a term.
60s parents, I mean they're
like the war period.
Yeah, they're the greatest generation. They're the like World War II post boom. You know, they're the ones that had enough prosperity and had enough sex to make the boomers.
Yes.
Right.
They were like the grafters that paved the way so the boomers could have the affluence.
And they're you know the Leave It to Beaver, White Picket Fence, oh my new oven, you know that post war boom, economic boom, that then created the baby boom.
I'm sure they probably do have a label and a title, but
yeah, I would wager, and someone will correct me, I'm sure, but I think they're the greatest generation, quote unquote.
The greatest generation.
I know.
Okay. Because I know like the 70s is like the me generation.
Sure.
I don't know what that
and
means.
These labels are all arbitrary and
yeah, exactly. You know. They were made up by people who, you know, just made them up.
Right.
Anyway.
But
it's really interesting.
Yes.
Because obviously this is something, and you know, we spoke about it literally in the last podcast. There's a big disparity, right, in age.
Yeah.
At the moment, and appreciating things.
Yeah.
And understanding things and other people.
Yeah. And you wonder if this is one of those, like, the pendulum swings about this thing, and the first time it swung in one direction was the 60s, and then it went back through the 70s and free love and hippies and all that, and now it's going back again the other way, and we have this adult-kid relationship again.
Yep. And it's just so, because, like, I just feel if, you know, Bye Bye Birdie went on today, and they sang about kids, right? And all the people watching it are the iGen or the Generation Z kids, or even just, you know, millennials like us. We'd be watching, being like, alongside the people who are like, oh, I remember Bye Bye Birdie, this is great.
Right.
And then hearing this kind of played back at them.
Yeah. It is,
I think that's really entertaining.
Bye Bye Birdie, even beyond some of its, you know, more specific dated references, I think thematically for that reason, is not headed for a Broadway revival anytime soon.
No. I mean, there's, I think there's plenty of reasons why that's probably the case.
Sure.
It's really funny.
Yeah.
It's really funny. And I now kind of want to just play it.
Yeah.
Whenever I have, like, a really, you know, patronizing conversation with someone of the generation above me. And I just want to be like, this is you. This was played for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it is, like, there's one. Hold on. I want to find it. It is one of my favorite monologues in all of musical theater. Mr. McAfee's monologue. I've tried to run this house on a democratic basis. I've extended the privilege of self-determination to both the woman I have married and the children I have sired. The vote has been denied to no one for reason of age, sex, or political affiliations. There have been no taxation without representation, and open covenants have been openly arrived at. Last night, I gave up my room to a guest who repeatedly referred to me as Fats. Telephone calls were made on my phone to New York, Chicago, Fairbanks, Alaska, and Hong Kong. I slept in a camp cot with my feet in the fireplace and my head in an ashtray. Outside my window, three harpies shrieked, "We love you, Conrad," 4,723 times. And I have just lost two fried eggs. Gentlemen, the democracy is over. Parliament has been dissolved, the Magna Carta is revoked, and Nero is back in town, and you don't offer an emperor a warm 7-Up. It's one of the best pieces of book writing.
That's really good
it's
writing.
It's so good, and it's so Harry McAfee, and it's so like an entitled boomer generation thing.
Exactly. But that's the thing is, you know, Harry McAfee isn't a boomer.
Right.
He is the pre, and yet we're listening to that, and I'm like, that is the exact same thing that we hear now.
It does. It is one of the, I wonder if I've ever, you'll know better than me about the words that come out of my mouth, if it's a thing I've ever said before, but I do think a lot of this like cyclical opinion of society is very much related to generations. And, like, especially in this particular moment, with my mom having the Bye Bye Birdie record, and I and my mom's great and I think has, like, a lot of not of those stereotypical boomer tendencies, but certainly her peers in age do. And she learned it from her parents. And so is there this, like, rolling cycle that's the distance between when people generally have kids? And so what, and that kind of like rolls and cycles. And so then whatever generation came next after my mom's parents, their kids, you know, the generation slightly younger than us are now representing, you know, whether it's like free love or hippiness or like whatever.
Right. Okay.
And are we starting to see those, like that tide start to wash in again?
Well, yeah, potentially. I mean, obviously who can say,
right?
Because it's I just think it's really funny because every single generation thinks they know best.
Sure.
And that is the kind of thing that stays, that's the kind of thing that always cycles around.
Yeah,
at all points.
Yeah,
we know best
and we're older, so listen to us.
Yeah. And I think what's great about the song Kids is it just flattens that.
Yeah. To like,
because it's a song set in the 60s about how good parents are in that era and how annoying kids are, and is now enjoyed.
Can I tell you, Kids was after I downloaded Your Good Man Charlie Brown off of iTunes.
Uh-huh.
Or this might have even been pre-iTunes. I might have like Napstered this stuff.
Whoa.
I know. And like typed in musicals or something. After oh my God, after I was done downloading VeggieTales songs. We can talk about that later.
That's all right. I downloaded some weird stuff. But, yeah.
But Kids was one of the first individual musical theater songs that I downloaded long before I even knew that this was a thing I was gonna like. And so I've known specifically the song Kids for a very long time.
Yeah.
And Paul Lynde has an aside where he says, "I don't mind the moonlight swims, it's the loop-de-loop that hurts."
Right.
I've done this show. I've done research into this show. And like later in Lot of Living to Do, they say loop-de-loop. There is a reference to Moonlight Swims, but like what's the loop-de-loop? Like I get contemporary teen slang. There is no way to find out what the loop-de-loop.
Nope. It's buried.
It's so, or maybe it was nothing. Maybe like this was the made up slang they're using in this particular moment. But
it's so interesting that you bring this up because I completely agree with you. I think it's so random and it had the same search.
Yeah.
Nothing. And I think like, I don't know, maybe it is literally, it's buried.
Yeah. But
in
like
the annals of time, because the references in Bye Bye Birdie are so specific.
Yeah. And like
I feel like it has to.
I can grok what Moonlight Swims is, right? They, you know, Conrad and Kim go for a moonlight swim, or maybe, right? You're gonna go skinny dipping or do something, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Loop the loop could be anything.
Could be anything. The only thing, maybe it was like, I don't know, a dance move, but that's
sure. But the implication in that song is that it's worse than Moonlight Swims.
Yeah, true.
Right? So what is
what is it?
I feel like, you know, we need an urban dictionary from the 60s.
I know. Hey, any listeners from the 60s? Maybe.
Yeah.
Let us know what the hell are loop-de-loops.
Yeah, they're not going to be listening anymore after we just spent the last 15 minutes insulting them and telling them about how entitled they are.
No, we weren't insulting them. Oh. We're insulting their parents.
Well, I think we just insult everyone.
Kids! I don't know what's wrong with these kids today. Kids, who can understand anything they say? Kids, they are disobedient, disrespectful oafs. Noisy, crazy, sloppy, lazy loafers. While we're on the subject, kids, you can talk and talk till your face is blue. Kids, but they still do just what they want to do. Why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way? What's the matter with kids today?
Yeah, okay, we bring up a good point.
Yes.
What would Bye Bye Birdie look like today?
This is a good question. Like, if you say, like, if we were given full reign to, like, revise, rewrite. Yeah.
There's a lot.
I mean, what's crazy is there's some real easy substitutions to make. You know,
mm-hmm.
Conrad Birdie could be any of the Jonas Brothers or Shawn Mendes or a whole slew of teen idols.
I mean, we're in fan culture land right
like
now.
In a snap. So much, like, in the fan culture land that, like, Elvis created, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, people.
Yeah, Elvis and the Beatles.
Yeah. People didn't scream at concerts before then.
Yeah.
You know, and they invented that. So, like, that sort of stuff is pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of the relationship stuff is actually a pretty mm-hmm. easy transference. You know, Hugo and Kim are having teenage relationship struggles haven't changed. Certainly, we might give the females more overt power. And I do think this is one of those, like, of its time things. I think the ladies in the show were powerful for the 60s.
Okay.
You disagree? You gave me a look.
I do.
Okay, tell me what you mean.
I think they're awful.
Really?
I think they're awful. Yeah, I think they're absolutely awful. I don't think they have any agency.
Rose?
Yep.
She...
Like, literally, you just have to... Like, come on. Albert isn't a nice
No, he's like, he's a sad
he's not a nice man.
He's a sad sack of a human.
Yeah, and he's really he doesn't listen to her needs. So much so that Rose then goes and lashes out and effectively, you know, enters into some very sticky situations.
Oh, sure. The Shriners Ballet? Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Right, yeah, let's segue. We'll get back to Rose. Let's just segue into the Shriners Ballet very
quickly. That you gotta cut. If we're redoing it right now. Here's the problem, though. I forget. It's been so long since I've watched the movie.
Yeah.
On stage, separated from some of the dark, dark terribleness of the connotations of the Shriners Ballet, as a physical piece of staging and choreography, it is clever and funny and, like, so comedic. It certainly doesn't imbalance how gross it is.
It's awful.
Yeah.
It's really misguided. I think even for then.
Even for the
60s? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's similar in tone to West Side Story when Anita gets attacked.
Sure. But there, right? When Anita gets attacked in West Side Story, it's taken with a tone of seriousness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is appropriate to the story.
Right. It is as heightened as that moment should be.
This is a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah. If you... Because some versions, I think the Jason Alexander one, the 1995 TV movie, doesn't have the Shriners Ballet, appropriately so. Although,
okay,
I got to think back. So some people, depending upon what version you've watched, in protest, Rose runs away to a dive bar, and there's a Shriners meeting going on in the back room, filled with men and fezzes, and to kind of like ideologically get back at Albert, she somewhere between flirts and gives all these men a blowjob.
Whatever happened under that table stays under that table.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, 12 or 13 men. And like, it's without context, is very funny to watch.
Yeah. It's disturbing.
Sure.
It's really disturbing. Anyway, to steer back into Rose, she even has a song. Her and Kim have a duet called What Did I Ever See in Him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That should be how their story ends.
Yeah, but that's where, like, this is where my thesis of for the 60s, these are powerful women. Because they get to have that song.
Yeah, but that song is completely nullified.
Sure.
What that song is that, ugh, how dare you even think that, silly women. Come back to your man.
Sure. Sure, sure, sure.
And I don't think them having that moment is empowering because it's taken away from them.
Yeah, I hear you.
If one of them, that's the thing, like if Rose struck out on her own at the end and Kim went with Hugo.
Yeah.
That's better.
Yeah.
It's not great, but it's better.
Yeah.
All it is that Rose enters back into an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
Like, I really don't like the women in this show. I was thinking, I get it's the time and I you know, absolutely, it's,
sure,
it is what it is.
But, but
comparing to even something like How to Succeed, right, which we've already lauded is
sure
not a great representation of women at all.
Yeah.
And it kind of teeters along the line of satire.
Yeah.
You know, but it still sits in the you know,
right,
do
right
as
in,
you're told.
Right side. In the pocket, yeah.
Right. Bye Bye Birdie is it's a satire, but it's a satire of rock and roll. It's not a satire of relationships.
Yeah, but you look at Rose and Albert's relationship, and like Rose like starts the show and is like, Albert, I'm leaving because you refuse to marry me because your mom's a dick.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's her world, and so I'm leaving, and spends the whole show threatening, like, if you don't marry me, I'm gonna leave. If you don't marry me, I'm gonna leave. And Albert's character progression turns into, fuck you, mom, I'm gonna marry her. In the Jason Alexander one, Tyne Daly falls into a lake. Albert's mom has the Cruella de Vil baked into a cake comeuppance at the end of it. And then Albert's like, Rose, I'm so sorry. Everything is rosy. I forgive you. I will reward you with this thing you have wanted since the top.
Yeah, me, the man. I will allow you to be my wife.
Sure.
You have lowered yourself and reduced yourself so much that you have been assaulted by hundreds of men. It is time to allow you to be my wife.
That's fair.
That's how I view it. And the thing is what I think is interesting is you've grown up with this musical.
Yeah. No, that's right? Fair.
So you've obviously, in the same way that I find it really hard to see the problems with Rent.
Right. Like if I just saw this musical with fresh eyes today, would I have a different opinion? Is it a good question?
This is all I see.
Yeah.
This is all I
that's
see.
Fair.
And it makes me really not enjoy it. What's that song that I think is abysmal? Baby Talk to Me.
I think that's phone.
It. He's basically, it's the literally like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Will you be my wife again? Yeah. And she's like, okay.
Yeah. Or it's a beautiful.
And that's all it took.
Or it's
that's
a beautiful love song.
It was in the 60s, absolutely.
Well, but see, that's the thing. And this is a thing I really struggle with. But I want to, I want to be better.
Also,
at
One Boy is really just.
Sure. Oh, from a contemporary standpoint, fuck One Boy.
Let me give myself to thee.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That one, I think, easier than Talk to Me. Because One Boy is also a rejection of rock and roll and that kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Getting pinned is an old-timey thing.
Exactly.
But, around Talk to Me, around all of this, it is so difficult to have the, a bifocal lens to view dated pieces through.
Yep.
Right? And I think the 60s especially, because values are changing so rapidly, we weren't there. And even the best historians or people who are trying to record what was happening are still giving us a skewed view of what values were at the time, because we're talking about values, the most subjective thing humans experience. And so to go into to be able to accurately analyze the art and to make assumptions about how people felt about it then and about how people felt about it now, and to know where the line, what are you going to be okay with forgiving people of the past for?
Mm-hmm.
Should they have known better? Fuck them. Or was it just the 60s?
Completely. And this is it. And this is something that we are going to keep encountering as we do this podcast. And it's in the kind of canceling culture that we have nowadays.
Right.
It raises a lot of challenging stuff.
Yeah.
Because I remember the first conversation I had where I kind of realized that, oh, actually, this is a big issue. There's no clear cut thing.
Yeah.
Was when I had an argument with someone about Rent.
Sure.
And I could talk about Rent for years.
Yeah.
About how important it is to me and how important it is to history.
Yeah.
But someone listening to Rent with a fresh pair of ears can tell me how problematic it is.
Sure. Well, and even, there's other lenses about Rent is a very real and very accurate portrayal of its time. And
absolutely.
Viewed through a contemporary lens, let's say Rent Live kind of perpetuates a lot of contemporary held stereotypes around HIV and drug use that are not true right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I understand this conversation and I can hear the debates I would have with people who adore Bye Bye Birdie.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And people adore this show.
Absolutely.
And they are absolutely allowed to.
Right.
That's the crucial thing.
Yeah.
Is we shouldn't be saying you like Bye Bye Birdie, therefore you hate women.
Right.
That isn't it.
Well, and I do think, and this is, as we've talked plenty of times, one of the very particular joys about musical theater, is this conversation is always more acutely pertinent with musical theater and with theater in general than it mm-hmm. is with more static art forms.
Yeah.
Bye Bye Birdie, the movie, is less problematic, I wager, than Bye Bye Birdie, the licensed script from MTI.
Yep.
Even if they're the exact same content. Yep. Because the film is done. And it's set, and it's not going to change. But you exactly. get a box filled with scripts from MTI with this text that you have decided you're going to recreate for a week or a month or however long in front yeah. of a bunch of people. And so you yeah. have to be more okay with that in 2019 than sitting down and putting on Bye Bye Birdie on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Which
I think that's a nice segue, Tommy.
Let's do it. Hop on.
Call me the wild Spanish rose. Craziest flower that grows. I'll kick up my heels and see how it feels to be sultry Spanish Rosalie. Behind my mantilla I'll pose. Love you. Exciting and cruel, that's me, Spanish Rose.
Mini Rosita Hernandez. You buy my tortilla?
You like me, yes, no, maybe, yeah.
Wee! That can we can add that to the t-shirt, hop
sure.
on. That's fun. So, hey.
Yeah.
You make a very good point.
Thank you.
Because the text can change.
Yeah.
And people have tried.
Mm-hmm.
So, this Bye Bye Birdie... Mm-hmm. There's like two distinct versions, I would say, that exist. Some exist a bit more than others.
Yes.
One of them being the movie mm-hmm. and the other being the... Apparently it's coming this year. I can't wait for it. That is not coming this year. It was just they said 2 years ago that it was happening in 2019. The upcoming NBC Live yes. production starring yes. Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
Both of which have substantial changes mm-hmm. to the book.
Yes.
So should we start with a movie?
Sure.
And talk about what's different?
Yeah. I mean,
because I think it's quite notable what's different.
It's fascinating. I think a lot of what's different certainly revolves around Aunt Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you just call her Aunt Margaret?
My Aunt Margaret, as you may know.
Do you have an Aunt Margaret?
Nope.
Fun story about the name, though, Anne Margaret. People used to always call my Gran Margaret. She is, her name was Margaret.
Right.
But it was always Gran Margaret.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I heard Anne Margaret, I was very confused because I thought they were like making a joke yeah. about my Gran.
Did like all the calculus math being. Like appear in front of your face and you start like throwing
yeah, exactly.
your eyeballs around?
Yeah.
If you've only seen the movie version, you need to know that the only song that was added for the movie version was the title song.
Bye. It's already played.
Right.
It's the opening.
It's the opening. and it was filmed months after the movie was done filming.
Yep.
In an effort to make the B plot the A plot. Is that a good way to put that?
Exactly. This is the most substantial change with the movie is the shift in focus of who is at the center of this story.
Yeah, which I would say, you know, interesting that we talked about the stage musical being very much for parents, and mm-hmm. this was a shift to make the movie be more for kids, maybe.
Yep.
Or for the director to get more personal time with Aunt Margaret.
I guess. I think there's arguments for both, Thomas. it certainly opened up...
Mm-hmm.
the story to kids a lot more.
Yeah.
Like, they do not feel nearly as put down upon in the film
mm-hmm.
as they do in the musical.
Yes. Yes.
The balance feels a bit more, well, balanced.
Yeah. They have more agency. They're more nuanced in their characterizations.
Yeah, exactly. And their stories mm-hmm. are just more significant.
Yeah.
They have a bit more weight to them.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, the focus has now kind of been shifted in the movie to Kim and Hugo's relationship and how that's affected by Conrad Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus is taken away mm-hmm. a little bit more from Albert and Rosie.
Yes.
And they're kind of, I would say they're kind of brought into a level playing field. To me, I actually think it's better book writing
mm-hmm.
because the mirroring mm-hmm. that we've already talked about yes. between those two relationships is a lot more apparent
yes.
in the movie as yeah. opposed to the musical.
Yes. Perhaps because...
And just like doing...
Perhaps because the kids are more human.
Yeah, completely. They make more human decisions. You see their reactions and you yeah. see their thoughts and their feelings a lot more. And they did really interesting things with that. And I actually don't think they were necessarily intentional.
Sure, yeah.
I think a lot of it was because of who they cast.
Right, yeah. No, I don't think... Yeah, I agree.
I don't think they set out to be like, let's change this book up a bit because it needs changing. It's only 3 years after.
Right, yeah, 1963. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. I think they were just like, wow, we found something incredible at Anne Margaret. We need to really push her up here.
Right.
I can't remember the guy who plays Hugo, but he has this incredible voice. Mm-hmm. He has the best voice in the film.
And he is certainly... Hugo goes from on stage being like an absolute, you know, glasses-pushing nerd to yes. being a like, well... we see that you're trying to put you in a frumpy sweater, but you know, girls are swooning for you. Everyone's exactly. swooning for you as well.
We're deep swooning. You have the best voice. Yeah. You're extremely sexy,
yeah.
And a good dancer to boot.
Yeah,
it's funny because what they then did was okay. Well, we need to give these guys more songs,
right?
So obviously, Anne Margaret gets the opening.
Mm-hmm.
She opens the whole film, so instantly your eyes are on her,
right?
And you're looking at her story,
yeah.
And then Hugo gets brought into mm-hmm. I Got a Lot of Living,
mm-hmm.
and more interestingly, I think the both of them are brought into Rosie,
yeah. Which is an interesting parallel to play. And they
absolutely is.
Kill so many of Albert and Rosie's moments.
Yes, they really do.
There's no English teacher. He's not an English teacher anymore either. He wants to be science teacher or something.
A biochemist or something like that. Yeah.
They also, and I wondered what you thought about this, but mm-hmm. Rosie Alvarez is now Rosie de Leon.
Yes.
And they get rid of Spanish Rose, and Albert's mother is bad, but not they cut, which I think this is complicated, but on its own I really enjoy in the stage musical Rosie's line where she goes, Spanish is not a religion.
Yes.
Which is I think in response to something Albert says, which I don't know, what's your read on this? I struggle with this
on what, on the Spanish thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know the casting decisions. I think they didn't want Cheetah Rivera.
Yeah.
And they found Janet Leigh and they wanted to put her on the spot.
Yeah.
She isn't Spanish.
Right.
And they weren't going to do that.
And so they cut it in the movie for that reason.
Yeah, I think so. And also it just then alleviates that whole plot line.
Sure.
You don't need to stress about that.
It's an easy reason to do that. But, okay. I put this argument out not knowing if I agree with it.
Yeah.
Giving what was written as a role for a Latina woman
yeah.
to a white actress
yeah.
and rewriting it to fit. Even yeah. if there is this, and I also think this is kind of dubious, but this argument about like, you know, is this a racist thing that we're doing about, you know, no one likes you because you're Spanish. Well, I'm not really. I'm from Ohio Pennsylvania. Also seems kind of racist.
the song, do you mean?
Like, getting rid of... There's an argument that I could see.
that, it's, well, it's whitewashing.
Yeah, it's whitewashing. And that's
100% whitewashing.
And that's racist.
That's racist.
Right.
Yeah. It's whitewashing.
It's whitewashing.
It's whitewashing. It's as racist as whitewashing is.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's a Hollywood decision for Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't put a Latina woman in the front of a white movie.
Sure. Like
a big white movie.
So the question I have, and we don't know the answer, would the live version that didn't happen of Bye Bye Birdie, starring Jennifer Lopez as Rosie, contain those songs and references again?
Yeah, I think they 100% would. So one of to move on to that, the NBC live version, its biggest hook was that it was going to be Jennifer Lopez,
right?
And it was Harvey Fierstein at the helm, and he was very open to changing as much as was necessary.
Fascinating.
I think one of Jennifer Lopez's big things was she was like, I want to portray a middle-aged Spanish woman.
Mm-hmm.
And was very adamant about that. I think what he would have done is what they did in the revival with John Stamos.
Okay.
The way they framed it there, what it was Rosie singing to May.
Mm.
May was on stage and Rosie was there mocking her.
And so then it is more like, is this what you want, white woman?
Exactly. Yeah. It's, this is the stereotype that you've made me. I'm playing up into this. Is this what you is this what you see? Is this what you believe?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And we're all looking at May as the villain here.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's...
And we're kind of along for the ride with Rosie.
Yeah.
That's how I think they would have done it in the NBC Live.
Yeah.
Just because obviously it's so close to the revival. The revival wasn't that long ago.
Right.
And I think that's a smart, I think that's a really, that's smart really clever decision.
Yeah.
I think that's good writing.
It is interesting to me that that kind of just fits pretty easily into that.
It reminds me of the change that Arthur Lawrence made when he did the 2008 Gypsy, where it was like, I don't know how to fix Gotta Get a Gimmick, but I can't cut it because it's Gotta Get a Gimmick.
Right.
I know what I'll do. I'll have them sing it to Louise. And it was like, that works. And I was like, oh, okay, so you contextualized it rather than just making it a showpiece.
Right, yeah.
And that's exactly what they did in the revival. I think that is
it's clever, it's thoughtful, it says that you're not just blindly putting this on stage, but you still, like, that's, you know, that is the bifocal reading, is like, this is a good song, it's a good song, we should keep it, but we have to do something to it for us to be able to keep it.
Exactly. So he's never said that that's specifically what I did, but that's what I would conjecture.
Sure.
The other big change that he was gonna do he recognizes that Rosie is poorly written, and tried his best to kind of elevate her.
Sure.
So she was no longer Arthur's secretary.
Mm-hmm.
They were both teachers.
Okay.
At a high school.
Okay.
So they had to scrap the English teacher because of that. I don't know the other specifics.
Right. How that all panned out. It's an interesting thought.
So, but it basically was to give Rosie more agency.
Right.
But I think he'd need to do a lot more choppy before he could fix that character.
Sure.
And she'd need another number.
Absolutely. And, you know, let's not even get started on the binary gender stereotypes, and like, there's other deeper problems in the show just in its way that it's not even considering some other things.
Right, exactly.
It just dives so blindly into some of this stuff.
Yeah. So it's interesting when it comes to adapting it and doing it now. I think it is a really interesting conversation to be had, because, and again, we had it when we talked about How to Succeed.
Yeah.
Because the Matthew Broderick one, felt as dated as right. any old yeah. chestnut. It felt awful.
Yeah.
But then the more recent revival with Dan
yeah.
Was a little bit better, and they started to recognize things in the way that they framed the songs
sure.
and the way that they directed it without actually changing much of the source material.
Right.
Where do we stand on
Bye Bye Birdie
actually changing the text?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, but not even just Bye Bye Birdie, just any of these shows
sure.
that are so contemporaneous.
And are you rewriting history when you do that?
Exactly. Is it the same show?
Yeah. There's a Lindsay Ellis, who's a fantastic YouTuber who we've talked about on the show before.
Yeah.
When we talked about Aladdin, had a beautiful video that everyone should watch and will absolutely be in the show notes mm-hmm. called Woke Disney.
Yeah.
That's about a lot of things. But one of the things it's specifically about is the live action Dumbo and how they wrote out the racist crows in it mm-hmm. Who sing the song When I See an Elephant Fly, which is maybe one of the most iconic songs of the Dumbo cinematic universe.
Yep.
And like
the Dumbo cinematic yeah, universe. Yeah. I love the Dumbo sequel with, I don't know, the pink elephants.
Don't give them any ideas.
I would watch that.
Yeah, I probably would too. But like, it is this question, and like her thesis is very much like Disney is trying to sell you its wokeness as a branding thing. And I think musical theater is a little less guilty of this. I think it is a little more wholesome in its attempt to rewrite or reframe or re-justify some, you know, less than PC pieces of history.
Yeah.
And it's, I also see the trap of like justifying something by saying, well, that's what it was historically, and that's the secret excuse mm-hmm. I'm going to use to perform my very racist thing, because it's a historical piece, right?
Yep.
Like, that's not
yep.
okay either. That's tricky. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's really tricky. I'm excited to see the West Side Story revival.
Me too. Very much. Yeah. Who knows?
I don't know. I've not done my research yet. I don't know what's changed.
I mean, they're certainly branding themselves as this time it's different. You
yes,
know.
Sir.
But if Oklahoma
because
can pull it off.
The movie
yeah.
is not.
Yeah, no, the movie's not.
So, yeah, that's it. Oklahoma did it.
Yeah.
West Side Story came just after.
Now it's time.
See, maybe Bye Bye Birdie will be in 3 years' time, but it will be a different
yeah,
show.
Yeah, the wokeified Bye Bye Birdie.
Do you know what? I think you could do it.
Yeah.
I think it's possible.
I think you could
too. I think
too.
It's possible because it is satire.
Yeah.
Because there's so much in it that is ridiculous.
Is so heightened.
You just need to twist that a lot more. I think
yeah.
you need to really push that nail and make the ridiculous characters
yeah.
nowadays.
Yeah. But Jimmy, you know what that means.
Ridiculous.
Is you're going to tune into late night television and you're going to see James Corden say, and now the cast of Bye Bye Birdie. And the light's going to ping on and he's going to go, James Corden. That will
yeah,
happen.
That's how the Tony Awards will open.
That's exactly
that year. Literally, if we time machine that, that is a.
Oh my God. Our Tony's host is James Corden. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
I'm surprised they haven't done that yet.
A good point. Maybe it's in the pipeline.
Trademark. Your royalties.
Oh, yeah. Does that work?
Yeah, you got to say it three
worked.
Times, though. It's like Beetlejuice.
Oh, okay, cool. Great. Trademark. I did it. The other version, just before we finish, that
yes.
I do want to talk about, it may be the most significant,
mm-hmm.
most important. It's not a version of Bye Bye Birdie at all. I just want to mention it.
Mm-hmm.
Anne Margaret in the Flintstones called Anne Margrock.
I thought you were going to talk about the Mad Men version.
Oh, no. I've not watched Mad Men.
Me neither.
I don't have that as a
They parody Bye Bye Birdie at some point. The,
oh, that's
just
nice.
The Bye Bye as an I never watched Mad anyway.
Okay. That is a really good bit.
Welcome,
Mad Men.
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's references we don't know hour.
Exactly. I've been told that I should watch Mad Men.
Yeah.
Yep. But Anne Margaret is really funny.
It is really good. Does she look up from whatever she's doing and look at the camera and go, it's a living.
Let's get this started. No, but oh, you were being the okay, we were hitting two different references.
We were. It was, this is comedy gold.
Honestly, people are in stitches right now. Listening to us. My dad wrote a porno, has nothing on this podcast.
We are professional podcasters.
Yes, we are.
Sometimes
it's the first thing in my Tinder bio. It's a much more interesting job than my actual job.
Now people will know it's really you when they're swiping.
Yeah, exactly. I ain't no catfish. I ain't afraid of no catfish. I don't know what. It's literally... Oh, it's only 1:30. That's not bad. I have no excuse.
Duper class, there's nothing left to say, but Conrad, you're a guest. Bye, bye, Bertie. Ta-ta, oh, sweetie pie. Bye, bye, Bertie. Time for me to fly.
Tommy, that was Bye Bye Burhee.
He's in the army now.
Burhee is.
Except somehow they made a sequel. I want to live my life not knowing anything about the sequel.
Have you ever listened? Have you never listened?
None. Nothing.
I mean, obviously, we'll need to cover it at some point.
Better or worse than Grease 2?
Oh, you're talking to a huge fan of Grease 2 right now.
Okay, wrong question. But I
do. I'm excited for us to do Grease 2.
I do have the right question for you.
Fantastically done. Tell me.
The original production of this musical tickles all of your senses the moment you enter the lobby. We're not sure if it had an official smell designer, but let's be honest, it probably did.
Urinetown.
That's it. The official smell. Ew.
See what I did there? If you would like to get in touch with us, you can, and please do. Our show Twitter is at Jim and Tomic, and our Instagram is also at Jim and Tomic. That is JimAndTomic. Jim and Tomic.
I don't like that.
Jim and Tomic. Or you can join the Reddit discussion. The links are in the show notes in your podcatcher right now. Or you can head on over to jimandtomic.com where they're there for you too.
And while you're there, you can check out our Patreon if you'd like to financially support the show. Thank you, as always, so much to our current Patreons. We adore each and every one of you. And reviews on Apple Podcasts are always super helpful as well.
They are indeed. But most of all, do you know what? It just helps us out when you tell your pals about the show. So word of mouth is key. Spread the word.
It's true. That's it. Thanks for listening, and cheers.
Cheers. I've ever done this before on pod?
No.
Ah! That's fun. I told you stuff would go mad.
Oh, man.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.